Macbeth is an unholy riddle we still hesitate to name for fear of retribution. Macbeth is to the theater world what King Tut's tomb is to archaeologists. The superstition follows that any company performing the play will be beset with horrible luck, ranging anywhere from uncanny accidents on the set to actual deaths within the company. 13 Omens Podcast is available at myspace.com/13_omens. Look for the link in the About Me section.
Hello, this is Francis Sampier, producer of the upcoming independent horror film, Moral Road. This is a horror film based on an actual Michigan legend about a ghost who's searching for her baby.
You are listening to Ghostly Time with your hosts, Doug and Scott L.
Paul Nation is the president of HHD Foundation. Paul made his first expedition with Dr. Carl Baugh of the Texas-based Creation Evidence Museum into the jungles of Papua New Guinea in search of an unclassified avian animal. Their research suggests that the rapin is perhaps a pterodactyl, and we're going to hopefully talk about pterodactyls later, that somehow survived extinction among New Guinea's many remote volcanic mountain caverns.
Yeah.
I would like to welcome to the show Paul Nation. Welcome to Ghostly Talk.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we kind of talked on break for a second. We were kind of going back and forth on the different names. And I know a while back, Doug brought this article in, right? And he was all angry. He's like, I want to talk about this for the first half an hour. Okay, you go ahead and talk about whatever you want. And I'm not quite, it don't all come back to me right now, but there's like 400 different names for the pterodactyl or something like that.
And they keep inventing new ones every day.
They keep inventing new ones.
At least that's what it looks like in the news. However, Paul was kind enough to explain. So I hope to go through this. The pterodactyl is what I learned as a kid. And it's this winged, lizard-looking, but with wings, and they show its eggs in the little, Scholastic reader books, and they're huge, and it lives on mountains. That, at least that's what you learn in Scholastic readers. But that's what I learned as that flying dinosaur, right? And ever since then, they've been trying to change its name. At least that's what it looks like in the news, because it went from pterodactyl to pteranodon to petrosaur to they just keep going on and on and on with this. And so I wanted to know what's up with that. And Paul, you helped me understand a little bit more.
Well, if you noticed your pterodactyl in your picture that in your mind, had a rounded bald head with a long tail.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, your pteranodon has no tail, but has a large crest on the back of its head.
And I've seen those. I've seen pictures of those, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, that's two families of the pterosaurs. One of them is called a Rhamphorhynchus, a rhamphorhynchoid family. The other one is a pterodactyloid family. Now, it's ironic that the pterodactyl is in the Rhamphorhynchus family and not the pterodactyloid family. Okay?
No kidding.
Oh, that helps add to the confusion.
Yeah, right.
And each of the family has several different species that have been discovered. And they classify them basically if they have a tail, they're in the Rhamphorhynchus family. If no tail and a crest, they're in the pterodactyloid family. So the pterodactyloid family was basically much... according to evolution, if you go with the theory of evolution, the pterodactyloids came later and they were more sophisticated. And don't quote me on that. Let me back up. I'm not that much of a scientist, okay? One of them is more sophisticated and more agile flying because of the clavicle rib cage attach point. So I'm going to get too sophisticated for my own good there. But anyway, both of them are supposedly extinct by 65 million years or more. So what got us into this hunt for this pterodactyl? Now, let me first say that I do not believe there's any pterodactyls alive in Papua New Guinea. I am looking for a Rhamphorhynchus.
Rhamphorhynchus. Okay.
Yeah, who knows what a Rhamphorhynchus is? So pterodactyl is the show name, the stage name for this creature, because you say pterodactyl and immediately we project an image in our mind of a prehistoric flying reptile. And we got started this hunt way back in 1993. And what started us was a GI who was now living in Montana by the name of Dwayne Hodgkinson. In 1944, he gave us the story that the war had just ended between Japan and the U.S., and he was still in Papua New Guinea in the town of Finchhoven. And he decided to take advantage of the lull before he got shipped back to the States. So him and a buddy and a national were going to go visit some of the local villages out in the bush. And on their hike out into the bush, they spooked up a wild pig and a clearing. And as the pig ran through the clearing into the far jungle, about 100, maybe 100, less than 100 yards away, the pig spooked up a large flying creature. Now, Duane states that when this creature took off the ground, it made a large swish, pause, swish, pause, swish, and it said it's very distinctive, very slow beat, and then it circled around him once and then took off. And he said, I got a good look at it for over a minute. And if you ever remember the cartoon called Alley-Oop?
I remember.
Okay, Fuzzy in the cartoon sometimes rode a pteranodon. And Duane, being from that era, said that was exactly what I saw, was what Fuzzy in the cartoon was riding. I saw that in life in 1944.
Wow.
Now, that started us curious because I'm a creationist young earther, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, well, that thing could still be alive, so let's go over there and look. So we go over there, fly to Finchhoven, start asking questions, and nobody in Finchhoven has known what we're talking about. They think we're crazy. They're, what are you looking for? And so we have a little private Cessna 185 bush plane, so we're able to fly to several more grass strips up and down Papua New Guinea. And suddenly we start hitting, oh, you're talking about Umboy Island. You're talking about the roping out there on Siasi. You're talking about... So they started picking up that, hey, we heard the stories from this island. So in 94, we went back to the island of Umboy and started climbing a mountain where this thing supposedly had its cave, and absolutely found nothing, okay? We interviewed a lot of people who have seen something similar to what Duane Hodgkins had saw. So we're starting to say, now, okay, they're telling us some descriptions of this creature. Now, you understand that these people, the country of Papua New Guinea has over 800 different languages in the countryside. So you can actually go across one mountain ridge down to the valley on the other side, and the people in the valley cannot talk to the people on the first valley.
Oh, my God.
With their mother tongue. I mean, they are very isolated, extremely rugged. They do have a trade language called Talk Pidgin that they can communicate pretty much along the seacoast with this language. But they don't get together and share village legends or village myths. And so as we would go from different language groups to different language groups, the description of this creature would remain amazingly consistent. You know, and so we're thinking, you know, they're seeing something because these nationals are not educated in the fossil record. They're barely educated in reading and writing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them don't even do that, especially the older ones. Now, they've done a fairly good job of trying to educate their young. So when we ask them, you know, what size is it? Duane Hodgkinson quoted that he saw was the size of his Piper Tri-Pacer airplane. I don't know if you're into aircraft anymore. That's an old antique conventional gear. It was a tricycle gear, Piper, but it had a 25 to 26-foot wingspan.
Oh, my God.
And in this, he swore, and he still does, he's still living up in Montana, that it had that big of a wingspan. Now, in the fossil record, the Quetzalcoatlus, the largest of the pterosaurs, has a 56-foot wingspan. The pteranodons can go anywhere from 20 to 30-foot wingspan, and then you walk your way on down from there. So, again, it's not too big for the fossil record, but it's extremely large for us Westerners to comprehend that this thing can still escape attention. Yeah.
Well, the thing you mentioned a second ago in the first account was that the sound they heard was whoosh, pause, whoosh, pause.
Right.
Whoosh. Now, from my limited experience with flying creatures, right, you know, I've seen a bird before. There's birds all over the place here by the winery and stuff. And when they, the little birds, they go flying, they're like, you know, they're small, right? Right. But if something gets larger and larger and larger, right, it seems they have, you know, the larger the wing, the less they have to paddle, it seems like, to get themselves in the air. So when you said whoosh, pause.
He's moving a lot of air under
whoosh,
his wing.
Yeah, exactly, right? Whoosh, pause. That sounds right. Like that was a big bird or whatever it may be, right?
A big creature.
Yeah,
right.
Huge creature.
Let's go back to 1875.
Okay.
That's probably even before the word dinosaur was even invented. This is a Nature magazine, volume 13, page 76. That was back when Papua New Guinea was just called New Guinea, and British explorers were having their heyday exploring things and finding stuff. There's an article written to this Nature magazine back in, it was dated from August the 30th to September the 2nd, back in 1875. And there was a Sir Henry Rawlingston was on a steamer, and the steamer had an engineer named Mr. Smithhurst. And Mr. Smithhurst, let me quote here, refers to a very remarkable bird which, so far as we know, has not hitherto been described. The natives state that it can fly away with a dugong, which is a manatee, a kangaroo, or a large turtle. Mr. Smithhurst states that he saw and shot at a specimen of this wonderful animal, and that, here again, quote, the noise caused by the flapping of its wings resembled the sound of a locomotive pulling a long train very slowly. He states that it appeared to be about 16 to 18 feet across the wings as it flew. The body dark brown, the breast white, the neck long, and the beak long and straight. So, if you ever heard of a steam engine like at Six Flags Amusement Park or something, when they first start out, how they sound, they go poof, poof,
yeah,
poof. So here, you got 1875, the same beat, so to speak, to 1944, the same swish and pause. Is that a coincidence? You know, Dwayne has never heard of this Mr. Smithhurst. I just happened to run across this a couple years ago. And so here again, this is some of the coincidental evidence that we are slowly gaining that really blows our mind, okay? Because we're open to, I'm always open to, you know, is this a hoax?
Right.
Am I involved in some nationwide hoax because I'm the only white guy on this island of 12,000 guys, you know? They all see me come and say, all right, get your stories together. This guy's going to put us on camera. And I must admit, I have, you know, we have to be careful because we have been subject to some of that because we hear these stories. Well, I didn't see it myself, but I had an uncle whose friend told us such and such. So those we'll listen to, but we don't give much credence to third, fourth, second-hand results. We've had enough first-hand eyewitnesses describing this thing to us that we go with those descriptions. But, you know, I'm always leery because I don't want to be made a fool of.
No, nobody does. Right. And any of these fields, I mean, when you're studying the unknown.
Always the possibility.
Yeah, you're always going to be risking that.
I have a question, Paul, about the rope. How do you have any estimate, or did the villagers have any estimate of a single specimen's lifespan? Because you've got to figure, you know, maybe grandma said, and then the daughter said, and now the grandchild is saying, you know, that this ropen, you know, has been around their village for multiple generations, or you know, how do the stories flow lengthwise in time?
I couldn't really tell you. I don't know. That's a question I really never asked because this ropen doesn't seem to have a consistent pattern of appearance. I went to this island twice, and the second time I left a notebook that was waterproofed that you write in the water in a pen, and my contact in this village has kept record of how many times they've seen it in the last 4 years, and they're only seeing it. He only has a record of it 3 times in 4 years. So we're under the opinion now that island possibly was just a visiting place, that it came every couple of months occasionally, did not have near the activity that we were looking for after we visited 3 trips. So that's why I just came back, 10 days ago from a new target area and had some pretty good success.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So,
well, this particular, I mean,
Because one of the things that I would do is I would try and trace the although like you said it is kind of impossible with the language barriers that you know they've sort of created among themselves.
Or yeah,
not
yeah.
not they didn't get together and say okay we're all going to speak different languages, but it just sort of happened.
Uh-huh. Right.
And so the language is going to be extremely difficult. But the folklore, if you might be able to get an idea of you know the lifespan. Do we have any idea from the fossil records what the lifespan of a petrosaur would be?
No, you might if you had a paleontologist who had studied that. I'm not real good at all that book learning. I'm more or less in finding one alive. I mean, rocks are fine, and it's interesting enough for me to study. Because I've got a certain amount of descriptions that these nationals have given me, and then when I start reading articles of what they find in the fossil record, it just coincidence come apart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you ought to also understand the size of this creature, and there's another characteristic that is unique. It's a scavenger. And when a person dies, let me just say in this island that we've been to, you're out at sea level, 7 degrees south of the equator, so you're running at 90 to 95 degrees humidity. You're running at anywhere from 80 to 95 degrees temperature. A person dies, they put them in a slab box now, literally just a slab box they make out of the next nearest tree, and that body is opened for viewing for 3 days.
Ooh.
So you can imagine with that embalming and everything, this body is smelling pretty ripe by the third night.
Mm-hmm.
This is a nocturnal creature, and he comes in looking for a meal. And so he has also developed a reputation of being a mazulai, which is an evil spirit.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So in their neck of the woods, to look upon it, to talk about it, sometimes can bring disaster, and at the least will bring bad luck. So that has been a big, a blocked hurdle to overcome, is to convince them that we're not looking for their god. We're not looking for their evil spirit to bring disaster upon this village. We really believe it's a big bird that's different and unique.
Mm-hmm.
So we've slowly, over the trips, developed a network of nationals that understand what we're trying to look for. And that has taken us almost 10 years, to develop that one trust that we're not going to make fools of them, because they are extremely sensitive to look very primitive to a white skin. I mean, whether it's an Australian, American, or whatever, because they are very sensitive about their belief system, because I've met people who claim that they can turn themselves into a crocodile. And he went to the next village and killed a couple of people, came back and turned himself back into human. And now we had a village war against each other with machetes. They'll fight and fight until somebody gets cut badly or killed, and then the war is over with. It's been retaliated. So that's still lingering in their thoughts, that's real and possible. And they take it very seriously that is the domain of this creature. So we're in a little spooky area sometimes with these nationals. In fact, last trip, I got so uplifted, or excited without being exuberant that we had a large flying creature resting on a cliff ledge about 5 miles from us, which is about a 5-hour hike, basically, in that terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And because it flies nocturnally. So I sent the two nationals with me because they're so much faster in the bush than I am.
Yeah.
They came back and described it as a large creature, but it had its head on its wing. They couldn't tell any more about it. So we were getting ready to go the next day when the landowner and the magistrate from the next village over refused us permission to go look at it because we would destroy their god. And we failed in 2 days in the negotiation to convince them that we're not going to do damage, we're not going to catch it, we're not going to do whatever. And so when the bush plane came to pick us up 3 days later, we flew over that spot, but of course there was nothing on the ledge at that time. So
mm-hmm.
So we're having to work politics and with religion in some of these areas. And so we sometimes have to worry about what kind of descriptions we get and try to convince them that this isn't going to bring disaster upon their family.
Well, it is obviously a very sensitive thing for a lot of these people. And to teeter that line with a lot of people that you may be meeting for the first time and explain to you what you're trying to do, I think they may have their outlook on when people come to that country to do this kind of research, like you just said. You know, are they, A, going to make fools of us? B, are they going to, like you just said, destroy, kill our God? We can't have them do that to us, you know. So that's why a lot of them, it seems like they may be tight-lipped about this sort of thing.
Yeah, and I mean, I've had several missionaries who've been over there for 20 years and want to laugh at me and say, oh man, I've been out in the bush all this time and I've never heard of such a thing. And I said, well, yeah, that's probably true. I mean, but by the same token, are there mountain lions in California? Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Do people get killed by mountain lions in California? Yeah. But how many people in California have seen a mountain lion out in the wild? Very, very few.
Very
people.
Few.
Because
right.
The majority of Californians live in Los Angeles.
Well, yeah, they don't live in...
Exactly.
When you think of California, you don't think of, like, you know, the rustic mountains of California.
Yeah.
You think of the sprawling metropolis of California.
Yeah. But by the same token, there is still a deadly four-legged predator that is existing in parts of California that, you know, people know of. We accept it as being there, but we rarely ever see it. So then you combine that with this environment as far as lack of communications and lack of ability to transfer news across vast areas of land, and this thing can be very localized, and the people 5 miles away would never even know about it. So it's an area that's extremely remote, but there's a couple of characteristics that we have come to put together in a composite picture that really makes some interesting coincidence with the fossil record. And one of them is their tail. Now, that's why I call this a rhamphorhynchus, because they say, well, the tail is long, and then there's a leaf on the end of the tail, or there's a cross on the end of the tail, or there's a bulb on the end of the tail.
Mm-hmm.
And in the fossil record, many species of the rhamphorhynchus have an appendage on the end of the tail that looks like a leaf. It looks like a cross member. It's a different type of appendage on the tail. Again, bears the question, how do these nationals give us descriptions that we only know from solid rock? Do you think they've seen something in real life? Or do you think it's just a coincidence? Another one is, how does that tail move? Is it a prehensile tail? By prehensile, I mean like a possum tail or a lizard tail or, you know, one that can be used like a monkey's tail that can move around and be like a fourth or fifth hand or something.
Yeah.
They say, no. The tail moves at the base of the body back and forth. It does not curl. And amazingly, again, in the fossil record, the first 13 vertebrae of that tail are like triple and quadrupled tendons onto the vertebrae, so that it makes for a very rigid tail.
And that's I can imagine that's more or less for flying purposes, too, maybe to stay the body as they fly.
That or when it walks upright. See, again, this thing doesn't walk like a bat, you know. Now, one time in a village of Opi, I picked up a bat to get ready to eat, and this bat's wingspan was almost 6 foot across.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, and this bat was, of course, is dead, so it's right in front of my face, about a foot-long body. And they're called the fruit bats. And they got them by the thousands. And so they don't mind hunting these bats and eating them.
Mm.
That's a protein source. So they are not afraid of bats. They know what bats are. Many times they'll keep these big fruit bats as pets, feed them, get them fat, then eat them. So
wow.
They know the difference between a bat. And many times people have said, well, you're just looking for a mega bat. And I said, well, if that was the case, these people would just say it's a big bat. But no, it's a different category of creature in their vocabulary alone. But it has, you know, if you remember a bat, it has three fingers on the wing, much like a pterosaur has three fingers on the wing.
Mm-hmm.
But a bat cannot walk upright because the membrane that it flies with is attached to its ankle.
Yeah.
So a bat can hang upside down from a tree limb, or it crawls around and shuffles around the ground. Sort of, I don't even know what it looks like, a crab or something. It's not very agile on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
However, this creature, he said, no, the wings are attached up on the hip much like the legs are able to be exposed in flight. You know, so they're giving us details, and we see that in the fossil record as well, where many of them, the membrane is attached up high in the hip area, and the wings are separate, and the legs are allowed to give it upright mobility so it can be a bipedal motion rather than having to walk on all fours.
Yeah, and it can actually walk on its own. It has that.
I mean, that's possibly why this tail is rigid, is for a balance weight, you know, when it does that. Again, we don't know. You know, I'm wondering, you know, these descriptions that they're giving me, they speak in their mother tongue to a translator, the translator speaks to me in English, and I've run across times where these words do not always mean the same thing as what we think they do in our minds. So we're getting a composite picture many times. So is that description matching what my imagination is developing? We don't know yet.
Well, what I want to do, we're going to take a quick break, but what I want to do is we've kind of talked about this creature a lot here the last half an hour. Got an idea, gotten a picture in all of our minds of what this thing could, the roping could possibly be. Now, you've been there three times, am I correct?
Correct, yes.
What I want to do, if you're okay with this, is I want to talk about the time you've spent there a little bit and some of the experiences you've had, because you've already mentioned that you had a very successful trip the last time you were there. And
right.
And Doug actually is like, he's drooling on his shirt because he really wants to know about this, right? So let's take a quick break, though, and then I want to get into the next half an hour and discuss your adventures.
Okay, that'd be
that's
great.
An adventure to me. The ultimate adventure.
Adventures are good to go for me.
There you go. This is Ghostly Talk. I'm Scott.
I'm Doug.
We'll be right back after this.
This is Zach. You might know me from Paratalk Chatroom or MySpace.com. I'm here to talk about Six Graphics, and Paratalk uses them on their website, www.paratalkradio.com. Six does the coolest graphics, signs, avatars, and anything you could want for your webpage. Visit her at www.freewebs.com/sixtoedkitty. Six Graphics, custom designs for paranormal minds.
I'm ready. what drives the man. The alcohol all in my brain. The Irish, when I'm the only blood in my veins. Saw myself tonight and the alcohol is all I've maintained.
Hello there, fiends. This is the caretaker for the Louisville Ghost Hunter Society's official podcast. And you're listening to an excellent, scary, spooky, freaky podcast that's been put together by lovely people who care about people like me, the bony undead. But anyway, I just want to let you know that the Louisville Ghost Hunter Society podcast is available at www.louisvillegs.com or on iTunes. So, haunt your iPod today and get me in there, okay? Possess me by your iPod. Make me feel at home inside your little portable MP3 player. And of course, learn about the paranormal and get freaked out along the way. Alright, back in the grave I go. But be sure and download our podcast and subscribe, because I'll miss you and haunt you if you don't.
Coming up, a half hour of living adventures.
Oh, yeah.
vicariously through our guest, Paul Mation, who has been to Papua New Guinea in search of Ropin.
Ropin.
Which is a cousin.
Big old flying thing. That thing is, I mean,
reptile-ish thing.
Well, from the descriptions, this thing is mammoth. It's just gigantic.
Well, yeah, size of a small airplane. And so we're talking about a thing that the folks have been seeing and experiencing. And evidently, it comes around. They notice it. They've developed it as part of their life. But
yeah.
it's infrequent at on the islands that he's been to.
Well, like any type of paranormal research. It's the same thing. When Paul mentioned that originally, that, you know, there's no pattern of when this thing comes around, it seems. I was thinking, hey, well, you know, by trade, we're ghost hunters, and geez, the same exact thing happens with us,
yeah,
too.
Same thing with us.
No different.
Yeah. So Paul, you've gone to these places, and you've done probably some pretty incredible things that you never in a million years thought you'd ever do. Go through jungles and mountains and villages with, obviously, issues with, government, because, like, the village government has all the say whether you can go places, and that's one of the examples you gave us. And so there's a lot of challenges, but it's got to be fascinating.
It is.
What kinds of things, like, you went once, you had the experience, that wasn't enough. So you went back twice. Why? What really draws you to that? In addition to, I mean, I'm sure the Ropin as well. But in addition to that, is it the nationals? Is it the intrigue? Is it the what causes you to go back?
All of the above. You know, this is your ghost hunters. You know, and how many times do you get to have your own little private ghost hunt that not many people are involved with, and you've got some inside information about something that's possibly very real, where the big guns haven't got a hold of it yet, you know?
Right.
We've been there a few times ourselves, actually, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
It does happen. It does happen, but it's rare.
Does.
You're right.
And I'm convinced, you know, I've been there and I've talked to people and I think they're seeing something that's real, that is unclassified, and what are they seeing? And you know, is it possible that something like this has survived? And so in my research, you know, you can go through and some of the similarities to the medieval times of the flying dragons are extremely coincidental. So you're thinking, some of those stories back in medieval times written about flying dragons, have some of the same experiences that happened here in Papua New Guinea, you know, 600 years later. The descriptions are extremely close.
Mm.
So is that another coincidence and such? But you're talking about, you know, some experiences, you know, in the jungle and such. And I love the nationals there. I've had extremely rare negative experience, okay? I feel extremely comfortable who I go with and where I go with. But at the same time, I'm extremely cautious where I go and who I go with. So, you know, those both work hand in hand. I'm not foolish enough to say, hey, let's go off this way. But I've gone into many villages, and I'm about 6 foot, about 240, so I'm fairly big.
Mm-hmm.
These people are about 5 foot, 120 pounds, extremely strong. I mean, they are workers, they are hikers, they are, you know, you don't get an ounce of extra fat on these folks, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They're lean and mean. I mean, they are just a very, I mean, they've hiked these mountains their lives. They're just, you know, it's nothing for them to hike 2 hours to school as kids and go 5 miles in jungle trails. And I'm talking about vertical climbs, 500 foot up and 500 foot down, several times between Bainu Village and Tawa Elementary School. I mean, it took me 7 hours to do that walk.
Wow.
Well, that was in the rain. The mud was slippery. I kept falling down because my hiking boots were so slippery. And they're barefooted, and they just scamper up and down this thing. But, you know, I'm going into a village, and the first time this happened, we had just come hiking down this heavily overgrown jungle footpath, and then we enter a clearing, and there's probably about 3 or 4 grass huts, okay? And you're out there, and the best thing you can do as a white guy is to smile, wave your hand like you're the queen of the Rose Bowl parade, and say, good day, mate, good day. That your show of friendliness reflects in their faces immediately. And they'll come over and they'll just take you. If you act silent and sober, they act silent, sober, and mean because you're an unknown, you're a threat. But if you're friendly, they're friendly. So I've just learned to be, I hate to be the term politician, but political. You just go in there and wave at everybody, you know, and people come at you. Okay, so we're doing this, and I've got a 4-year-old kid, a young boy, stark naked, being drugged to me by a 10-year-old girl or 12-year-old girl, and the little 4-year-old is screaming his lungs out. His eyes are huge, white, and he is screaming so loud it's ear-piercing. It's uncomfortable. And I'm thinking, something's wrong with this picture. Here I got this little 4-year-old screaming himself to death, and all these adults and this little girl are sort of grinning and smiling. And so I'm thinking, something's not right here. But it was so uncomfortable that we left. We didn't stay and visit with these people. We just kept hiking out of the clearing. So when we got back into the jungle, I asked my national, said, what was all that about? He just laughed. He says, you know, out here they have a story that they tell the young kids, if you don't obey me, I'm going to feed you to the white man. And you're the first white man that kid's ever seen.
Oh, my God.
Oh, you talking about, and I've had that happen to me multiple times. And so now when I see that happening, I'll say, no, take him back. Get him away. And an hour later, the little kid will come up and start rubbing your arms because they have no hair on their arms. And I've got hair on my arms, and I'm white, and they start petting you and seeing that you're real. And, you know, you got friends then. But, oh, that's the funniest thing now that I know what's going on.
Well, it's interesting because that's also got to be a parallel. There's a parallel thing going on because we talked about how infrequently the ropin are seen, right?
Right. Uh-huh.
And now we're talking about a 4-year-old kid is being dragged over to you, and he's absolutely terrified by you. And you're obviously extremely real. Mm-hmm. And you're, you know, flesh and bone, and you're there, and you're there to visit, and you're acting friendly, but yeah. He's scared to death of you from, you know, obviously legends.
Stories, yes.
But,
oh, yeah, I mean, because, you know,
he's never seen you guys before, never seen us, you know,
yeah.
the non-native folks, and so that's got to be an extremely rare event for them.
Yes, yeah. And so, like I say, you almost feel like a rock star or something because you're everywhere you go, you got 40 kids around you and people looking at you and wanting to see what you're doing. And and you can't communicate to them.
Right.
You know, you can jabber, and they jabber back to you, and if your translator's not close by, you just, you know, you're making sign language and laughing a lot.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the best thing you can do, because they understand you're not a threat, and so they come up and want to see what you're doing, and a lot of them, like I say, they just want to look on the backside of your hands, because you're white all over. You know, their hands are a little lighter color on the inside and such, and, you know, they just come up and more or less just feel your hair and feel your arms and say. But you also understand they have an ancient religious belief system of animists, and one of their beliefs is that their ancestors will return to them with presents and gifts, and their ancestors will come back as spirits, which is white.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened many years ago when the first white explorers showed up. They thought they were their returning ancestors. And these explorers showed up with gifts, you know, machetes, iron, steel, pots, and pans. And so for a long time, they really, almost like the Mayan and Mexican Indians, understood that these white guys were their returning ancestors bearing gifts.
Oh,
so
wow.
There's still some of that deep-seated belief that, you know, we are powerful, we are important because we are white. And that is also a protection that I use a lot of times because I don't feel threatened. And sometimes I'm more concerned about the nationals that are with me because they're black and they come from different tribes and different clans, and there's a lot of animosity inter-tribally over there where they can, if you just happen to be from a different clan, they will, you know, treat you rougher or whatever. And,
yeah.
And there's still some lot of barbaric acts that have happened within the last 5 years that just, you know, to us Westerners is just extremely shocking. But over in their society, that's just the way they do business.
Mm, amazing.
And so that's another thing. One of the other interesting things is sleeping in a hut. You know,
mm-hmm.
They live in a disposable society, which, you know, we over here we think a disposable society, we got to dispose. No, nothing like what they live in. They live in a grass hut that they replace every 5 years due to termites or the rain deteriorates. When they want a plate, they go out and get a big banana leaf or a palm frond or something, throw their food on that banana leaf. When they finish eating, they throw the banana leaf away. They cook with bamboo. They'll cut the section of bamboo above the joint, stuff it full of cow taro and some greens, cook that over the fire, knock it out of the bamboo onto a leaf plate, throw the bamboo away, you know, eat the greens, the cow and the taro, and throw the leaf away. I mean, they eat with their hands. They don't have anything like that. So they come from a very disposable site where they get everything they basically need from the jungle. And it's amazing to see how sophisticated they are. They call themselves primitive, and I've said, no, you're not primitive. I'm technologically advanced for you, but you leave me out here in the jungle by myself, I'm going to die of starvation because I don't know what to eat out here. I can't start a fire. They know what trees are around that are living that are extremely easy to start with. They can start a fire so fast, and I got these old cigarette lighters and everything, and I can't get anything to burn because it's so drenched with water.
Right.
You know, so they have all that inborn, I guess not inborn, but taught abilities that are just makes them survive and live subsistence-type lifestyle. By the same token, though, they're always in their gardens because if they don't keep their gardens up, they don't eat. There's no way of making an income. You know, there's no industry. It's just, you know, you just get what you can from the jungle, and then that's how your mama did it, and that's how your granddaddy did it, and that's how you're going to do it. So it's sort of sad in that way.
Do they have any, I don't know, I can't think of it. Typical of America would have, you know, an ambition of some kind. Like, my ambition is to, I don't know, write a book or attend 47 plays or,
okay.
Yeah, or get a
go to college
degree.
Yeah.
You know, I've got these little ambitions throughout life. They're truly day to day then it
Correct,
sounds
yeah.
like.
Yeah. And I hate that term a village. It takes a village. I thought the author of that book has never lived in a village because the village environment is so conducive to slavery. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I have been asked by the nationals of Gomelagong Village to stay there and rule over them. I said, you don't need some white guy to make rules for you. Well, we can trust you. We can't trust our own people. I said, well, that's the problem of accountability. You're going to have to learn how to hold your public officials accountable for crimes. Well, they're relatives. And so in the village, you got your tribal leaders, and if the tribal leader says no, you have nothing to do. If you want to start your own coffee plantation, you've got to go through the headman of your clan. He goes to the tribal leader of the village, and if they all say yes, you're allowed to do the entrepreneurial thing that you want to. If they don't want you to get some power or money, they can say no, and you are held down. And so this is that system that just stays there, and it stays there. And they respect it highly. But the only way they get it in advance is to go to the big cities. Well, now you got these cities loaded with uneducated people from the bush, and now they have a tremendous crime problem because these people want to go take stuff rather than work for it. And so it's hard to see. I mean, it's just, I've so many times wanted to throw money at a problem, mm-hmm. and then I see money causes more problems than it creates over there. And I'm working with that foundation of trying to get funding to go back and to poke a well for potable water into Gomelagong Village. Mm-hmm. Because you don't realize that there is no filtered water on the whole island for 12,000 people. The way they get their drinking water is they'll take a bamboo pipe and they'll slam it up into the side of a hill and let it run water for several days, and that's their drinking water.
Oh,
and you
wow.
got to go down to the bottom of the hill with your container, and you got to hike back out at the top of the hill with your container. And if you don't boil it even after that, typhoid can run rampant.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's just simple things that we take for granted. I was in Lab Village, and this is one on the seacoast. And I was so impressed because I was in a guest hut, and you go outside the guest hut, and there's a hose bib, an outdoor faucet. You open up and water comes out. Oh, man, you're talking about after being in the bush for 2 weeks and not having to go get my own water. I got a water faucet right there that I can wash my utensils off after each meal. Oh, man, I'm in luxury in hog heaven.
Like, yeah, the Holiday Inn over there.
Yeah, so I said, well, how did y'all get water here? Nobody else in this whole island has water. And so we just dammed up the river and we just got the river water coming down here.
Oh.
You know, so, yeah, it's great. You got river water outside your hut. But you still got to boil it and filter it and do all the stuff
yep.
to it. But that was a high-class subdivision, so to speak, of all the huts, because each hut in that area, there's probably about a dozen of them, had their own outdoor faucet. And they had tin roofs and they had wood sides on their huts.
Wow.
So, yeah. You know, so you take for granted that. Take for granted in the area I was in, probably within a 100-mile radius, I was the only guy with toilet paper.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, things of that nature that, you know, your outside toilet is just a little hole in the ground surrounded with banana leaves for privacy. And, you know, so at night when you need to get up and it's a couple hundred feet away from the village and you just got to go downhill in the mud and slip and slide and take care of business. And it's just... You're so thankful to come back and sit.
It sounds like looking for roping isn't on the easy side.
No, not at all.
No, if it was, somebody else would have already done it.
So then about the because I went to there was a link to a page. It's not your website, but it's a website that mentions you several times
because
you've been in there. There's a book. About the roping.
Yeah, Jonathan Whitcomb has written a book called Searching for Roping, I think is the name of it, on Amazon.com. And, yes, I'm in there. Most of those pictures are from me. Jonathan went once to Opie and Gomelagong Village, and I put him in contact. So Jonathan and I are still he was just here at the house last Monday videotaping some of my experiences from my last trips. Because he's got a second edition coming out, and he wants to include some of this new information. So he's done a pretty decent job of documenting what information has been gleaned, you know, from several trips since 1993. So, yeah, that's on Amazon.com, I think it is, with Searching for Roping. Jonathan Whitcomb. That's excellent. Yeah.
Jonathan.
It sounds like the easy way to go searching for Ropin.
Yeah.
you can do it from the comfort of your lazy boy recliner.
Yeah, but you never know if I'm telling the truth. You got to go out there and find out if I'm exaggerating, you know.
Touché.
Well, you mentioned that you had a very successful last trip, your third trip there. And we got about 5 minutes left, but I was wondering if you cared to elaborate on maybe a couple of experiences you had on this last trip besides the water and stuff like that.
Well, there's one characteristic of this Ropin that is extremely weird, as if this hadn't been weird enough. My question throughout this time was, there's no flashlights on this island. There's no artificial light on this island. How do these people see this creature at night? You know, here in America, if an owl flies by me, I can't tell what it is.
Yeah.
So how do they see this creature all the time? Everybody sees it at night. Hold your hats. This thing has a bioluminescent glow to it.
Really?
Interesting.
Okay.
Now I've only heard of that with very deep aquatic animals.
And also things like fireflies.
Fireflies,
exactly.
Yeah.
So the first probably several times that we were told this, we were not expected that, and we sort of, okay, next, let's put that guy aside, let's go to the next. But you go from every language group, and their response was, it glows. Okay, with
wow.
The time left, you know, I could spend a whole another hour on
this. Oh, I can imagine, yeah.
Okay, because I did not accept that at first. I thought, that's impossible, it's impossible, it's impossible. However, in our research, again, this is very condensed. There's three colors this creature was known to have glowed, okay, if that's the right word,
mm-hmm.
Bioluminesced. First is a bright white, quote, like a Coleman lantern white, big bright white, big white. And I thought, okay, big white. Second is a bright yellow like a kerosene lantern, okay? Now, the kerosene lantern has sort of a yellowish tint to it.
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. And the third was like a red-hot rock, because we saw them cooking with red-hot rocks when they cook pigs. They'll dig a hole in the ground, heat rocks for hours, and these rocks will actually glow reddish.
Mm-hmm.
Put the rocks in there, cover with banana leaves, da-da-da, next morning they cook it out. So there's these three colors. Okay, so we had heard of this Mount Hamya, close to a village that shall remain anonymous. And it's 150 miles inland from where we were on the island. So this is the new target area I just went to. I'm out there watching at night, and I see one of these bright white glows coming to me. Uh-oh. Ah, you know, they did not exaggerate at all. It is a bright white glow. How it makes its bioluminescence, I do not know, but it is extremely bright. Nine times on three separate nights, I saw bright white and the bright yellow glow as it flew to and from this mountainside, and once it flew along a mountain ridge going north to south, and I was facing east. So, to me, that was extremely successful because the nationals were not lying about the bioluminescence of this creature.
So it has a set of headlights, basically.
And there was nothing. And there's nothing on these islands that.
There is no artificial light of any type that you can see. In fact, when they make a fire, it's inside this grass hut because of the rain, and so even their fires they make are inside, not visible outside. So, you know, we have found a hot spot where I, as the first American to really see this glow, and again, I saw it on three separate nights and a total of nine different occasions. So to me, that was exciting because the nationals have not exaggerated or lied about that bioluminescence. What does that mean? We have no earthly idea.
Are you going back?
Yep. But I'm going to sort of keep that date quiet.
Of course. Are you considering taking, high-speed camera equipment and lenses that are about 2 foot long and things like that?
That all depends on the funding I'm able to project and get into be placed. Right now, the funding has been extremely limited.
Oh, yes.
Because it has been. And the reason I'm sort of keeping it quiet is I've got two organizations out of California with big bucks that are asking me all sorts of questions, but I'm not included in their plans.
Oh. I don't like
that
part. Yeah.
You know, well, I've done all the footwork, and I've sort of proven – that this thing exists. So now they're willing to put the big bucks in the big effort behind it, but with their people, with their ways, and, you know.
Right.
And I thought, wait a minute, you know, I'm the one that's been there and got the information, so I'm going to start clamming up a little bit more. But yeah,
I don't blame you, but you have thrilled us.
this is fascinating. I mean, this creature.
Yeah.
I'm definitely intrigued, and I have to thank you so much for coming on the show. And
my pleasure. I've enjoyed the time with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I mean, telling us some stories about this and explaining what this creature really is. And I mean,
hopefully, you know, within a couple of months, or I want to say within 4 or 5 months, we'll have even more information. And I'm within 2 miles of its nesting site.
Excellent.
Wow.
Okay, that's what is exciting to me.
Very exciting.
I ran out of time due to the rains and trying to get the bush plane to come in and pick me up without missing my international flight. And that really put a crimp in things.
Hopefully we'll be hearing from you again to talk about this some more down the road. We'd love to hear some more about this.
I am so looking forward to hearing updates. And
okay.
Of course, the second in the series of Searching for Ropin, the book, by Jonathan Whitcomb, right?
Correct, on Amazon, yeah.
On Amazon.com. So.
Definitely check it out.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Paul, hang on the line.
I enjoy it.
Thank you. Hang on the line for one thing. We're just going to go to break, Paul.
Okay.
Guys, this is Ghostly Talk. We haven't talked about cryptozoology in a long time.
And it's one of my favorite subjects.
I know,
so.
And it's been really fun talking about that. I want to take a quick break, though. Coming up, we have Miss Pamela Heath going to be coming on, talking about, of all subjects, suicide.
What happens,
though? It's an interesting idea. Let's talk about that after the break.